Good evening, and welcome to the May 2018 meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. First item on the agenda, as always, is we all received a copy of the minutes from our last meeting in April. Any additions, corrections, comments?
No.
If not, we will let Jean go ahead and publish them in the appropriate spot. This is the time in our meeting when we would invite anybody in the audience to make public comment if they would wish to speak on something other than what we have as scheduled agenda items that are within the scope of interest of our health commission. Seeing no one come forward, we'll go ahead and move on to our evening's presentation. So you'll recall actually it was a year ago, I looked it up, that Guy was here with us talking about our new cannabis legislation and what we were going to be looking at and some of the things that the county was looking at. It was still early on and nothing was in place, but we were anticipating them. So we've asked him to come back this evening and give us an update on what we should be watching for, what the county's doing. And remember, it's the county, not the individuals of cities that we're talking about. So we have with us Guy Savage, who is our Assistant County Administrative Officer, and the floor is yours, Guy.
All right. Well, thank you very much. A year already. Wow. Time flies when you're having fun. I feel like I'm at a pension trust meeting because I'm usually up there and the audience looks exactly the same. I think it's the same people that are in our audience. Show up for your audience. As noted, I'm Guy Savage with the County Administrative Office. It's been a busy year, that's for sure. And I've got an overview presentation for you, but please, if you want, I'll leave it to the chair there. Interactive is perfectly fine, or we can wait till the end and do questions, whichever way you want to go. I tried to cover the entire spectrum of things, so in some ways, waiting till the end and we can flip back maybe might be easier. So, first off, you know, this all started before Prop 64, but I was going to focus on what happened with Prop 64 in the subsequent trailer bill known as SB 94. I call this my top 10 just because, you know, it sounded like it'd be kind of fun to have a top 10 list for a change, right? So this is Guy's top 10. It's not necessarily the top 10 to those in the industry. It's not necessarily the top 10 for those in the health industry, but it's Guy's top 10 when we think about Prop 64 and SB 94. So the first thing is you got to come up with however you're going to pronounce that acronym. MACRSA? I don't know. Medicinal and Adult Use Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act, which is what we signed. So here's the top 10. Of course, it legalized medical and adult use, often referred to as recreational. It allows possession of 1 ounce or less if you're 21 years old or older. It created this bureau called the Bureau of Cannabis Control, which has undergone some name changes and has been broken up into other things, and we've got all these state agencies going on, but that's the main one it created. At the state level, it created a tax of 15% excise tax, and then $9.25 per ounce of flower, $2.75 per ounce of leaves. For employers, you know, it didn't touch any of your rights and regulations or what you can do as an employer. You could still require a drug-free workplace. For instance, here at the county, we treat it much like we would as alcohol at this point. There's this little thing called local control. Of course, what that means is that it's set up in a dual licensing sort of a mode, meaning you have to get licensed and permitted from your local jurisdiction and the state. It's not either or, it's both. And so that was a really important one for us locally. Public health and safety issues, the one that most people point to has to do with there's no proven test today for cannabis and driving under the influence of cannabis. As I think you probably all know, THC, which is the psychoactive component in cannabis, stays in your system a very long time. And so it may have been weeks since you last partook in cannabis, and yet you could still have residue THC in your system. The other thing we know, or learning, I think, is that THC affects people differently, certainly as individuals, but also if you're a long-term user, the way THC might affect someone who isn't a long-term user is quite different as well. One of the things a lot of people forget about is advertising limits. It actually, Prop 64, SB 94, actually placed some limits on advertising, how advertising can be done. Most people think of it in terms of like the Joe Camel ads. You know, you can't advertise directly to children using cartoon characters, that sort of things. But it's created some additional kind of unique rules around advertising. I've been wondering about, we've got a billboard on Highway 101 northbound. I'm not sure that's legal under this. So I've been asking that question. I haven't gotten an answer because, and I think it may be because of the business type, it may actually be exempt, but because it's not advertising, sale, distribution of cannabis, I think it's for one of the kind of support businesses, we'll call it. I think it's slow something or other biz. So anyhow, I don't want to give them any buzz marketing here in front of this huge crowd. Resentencing has been a big issue. Of course, Prop 64 and SB 94 allowed those that had previously been convicted of cannabis-related crimes to be resentenced. Some jurisdictions have done it wholesale, one swipe of the gavel, bang, 3,000 people, your backgrounds are expunged from those previous infractions of the law. Others taking different approaches. And the last, but certainly not least, in my top 10 is the black market is still strong. There's a lot of concern about both the combination of state and local taxes actually encouraging or supporting the black market because the cost for legalized cannabis could end up being quite a bit more than illegal black market cannabis. So it's still strong. I think if you saw today's paper, there was just a big seizure just down in Santa Barbara. I forget what it was, 3,000 pounds, I think it was, of black market cannabis that came up from Mexico. So it's still strong. But, you know, there you are. There's our new sign. Welcome to California. Prop 64, I like to throw this in there just to give it some context for us locally in our county. You know, you can see the various districts. That's our county map. It's small type, but you can kind of get a sense. By district, every district voted in favor of cannabis, not always by a huge margin, but every district did vote in favor of legalization of cannabis, Prop 64. Countywide totals there, you can see a little over 57, almost 58% in total voting yes, a little higher than state numbers. Now, here I'm talking about the broad San Luis Obispo County, the jurisdiction, the geographical boundaries. So, as was noted, and I think you all know, the rules in each jurisdiction are different. I think the only thing we agree on is delivery is okay. That's the only thing I think we'd agree on. Now, we're not saying you can have a delivery service within your city, but we are saying if somebody wants to have one outside of our city and deliver or into our county, we're saying, I think universally at this point, every jurisdiction says that's okay. Grover Beach, just to give you a flavor of some city kinds of stuff, Grover Beach and Morro Bay say storefronts, meaning someplace you can walk into and buy product, are okay. Nobody else says that at this point. Everybody else just saying you might be able to have one of these delivery services, but you can't walk in, see, touch, smell, whatever you want, product. Morro Bay did this thing that I've often puzzled over. They say everybody else where you can have personal grows says, yeah, you can grow your six plants. They have to be indoors. Morro Bay, as far as I understand, said, no, you can grow your six, and two of them can be outdoors. The other four have to be indoors. Must have been a compromise somewhere in there somewhere. I'm not quite sure. The majority of the cities, as you can see here, said no commercial cultivation. AG, Tascadero, Paso, Pismo, Morro Bay, and SLO all said no commercial cultivation. Grover Beach said yes, but only indoors. Here at the county, I'll get to that in just a minute, what we're doing. But it just goes to paint a rather kind of fractured picture. And if you're attempting to find cannabis, be in the cannabis business, understand what might be moving into you next door as a business, check your local listings because it's going to change. And I think that's the last point there. It is ever-evolving and changing. It seems like every other week there's a city council that's taking up some portion of this discussion. Picture down there at the bottom is kind of fun. I was at CSAC, California State Association of Counties, meeting a year ago. And I was sitting at, you know, as you do with all the other county supervisors and CAOs, sitting across the table, and somebody handed that to me. I said, what is this? And they said, well, you want to see what the packaging is going to look like? Here it is. So this is a guy from Humboldt County, and that is Dragon's Blood, I think it's called, or something like that. That's their packaging. And if you look at the picture on the upper right, you can see that little orange symbol with the scan me kind of thing. That was an attempt to meet the state regulations around track and trace. And on the backside, so that's just flipped over, you can see the little cannabis flagged thing there on the upper left of the lower picture. Turns out this doesn't actually meet all the requirements because it's not a fully opaque package. So there you go. So here within the county, now we're moving just to talking about the county as a legal jurisdiction. So we allow most license types with restrictions, and I'll get into some of those restrictions in just a minute. We, of course, allow dispensaries, but we only allow delivery. We don't allow currently any retail. So you can't walk into any store as a consumer, whether medical or for adult use, and buy product. You can make phone calls and you can get it delivered. We allow businesses to do that to get licenses. So that's what we're allowing. We allow nursery, which is a special type of cultivation license. We allow both personal and commercial cultivation. I've got a slide next that'll give you a little more detail on that. We allow manufacturing. A lot of jurisdictions have banned all manufacturing. Some have banned just volatile. We took kind of that middle ground as well with that. So testing, for whatever reason, a number of cities banned testing. That seemed maybe an important item for you guys, and one certainly for me and Dr. Penny here. If we're going to have this product in our community, let's have testing facilities that make it safe. They don't store tons of it. They might send, a cultivator might send over a bud or two, right, to get it tested. So let's make sure it's safe if we're going to do this, right? Why they banned testing in many cities, I don't know. Maybe it was just part of the broader ban. They said, we're not going to allow any of this stuff, and we'll put testing into that bucket as well. I know that Grover Beach does allow testing because they were one of the first that kind of got out there before everyone else. At the county, we've got kind of two things you need to be pursuing. One is the business license to be a licensed cannabis-related business, regardless of which one of those business licenses you get. And, of course, you have to have a land use permit. And the land use permit, depending upon what you're trying to do, the requirements for that will vary. So here's a snapshot of some of those things. As I said, personal cultivation, we allowed just indoor. We don't allow personal cultivation outdoor currently. There was a lot of discussion about that one because particularly when you get into areas like, say you live in a condominium, you're awfully close to your neighbor, right? So we said yes, indoor, and there are other restrictions around it. Cultivation, which is where we were having most of our conversation a year ago, ultimately we implemented urgency ordinance number 3334 that set kind of the initial ground rules for cultivation. It resulted in a number of things, and I'm going to come back to it in a minute because it ended up being the foundation for our approach to cultivation in our permanent ordinances as well. So some of those limitations on cultivation, you can see them here. In ag areas, you have to have a minimum of 10 acres. In rural land, you have to have a minimum of 50. Residential rural, a minimum of 20. You can only do it indoor. Industrial, you can only grow indoor. So as you can see, if you're trying to get into this business, whether you registered under 3334 or not, you now have to move to a proper land use. So that's created some issues for some of the folks that were cultivating under our registration under Urgency Ordinance 3334. Importantly, I think for many of us, there were setbacks that were included in our permanent ordinance. To our biggest complaint, obviously, is the smell. There was another article in today's, I don't know if it was the LA Times or the Santa Barbara News Press, about smells in Carpinteria and how they've gone from growing flowers to cannabis. And all you have to do is drive to Carpinteria in the evening on the freeway, roll down your windows, you'll smell cannabis, guaranteed. There's a school there that a friend of mine's kids were going to. They're now a little bigger than going to that particular school. The teacher used to have to come in the morning and open windows because it would get kind of smelly through the night because the cannabis cultivating operations would open up all their vents and the winds would blow. It would blow right toward the school, so she'd come in to open up her windows in the morning. Yeah. Water, of course, in our county, ever important. So we do have a water offset program tied to particularly cultivation. I'm not going to play this one. I'm going to play another one. But if you get a copy of these, and I'm happy to share them with you, there's a video that we've created as part of our educational program. If you just click down there where it says Know Before You Grow. And if I could, I'm going to hand these out. I'm going to talk about this more in a minute, but the video kind of mirrors what's in this handout, so I figured I'd give you the handout now. Okay, so by the numbers, here we go. Cultivation licenses. This has been a hot topic in front of the board the last few meetings. There's been a lot of question about, well, how many did we license? And, oh, my gosh, you know, I meant to do this, and I checked the wrong box, or I checked two boxes. And so the final in our urgency ordinance says we will issue 141 cultivation licenses. Okay, that much is clear. Now it gets a little dicier, that whole which box did I check? Under urgency ordinance 3334, there was the ability to say I'm a personal grow or I'm a commercial grow. In the end, we've identified 172, the original 141 we thought we had, plus another 31, that we believe should have been treated as commercial grows under the registration and under urgency ordinance 3334. But the ordinance is real clear. We're only going to issue 141 licenses. We've got 172 growers. Okay? So far, to date, we started collecting registrations basically the 1st of January. It was a holiday, but, you know, 1st of January. We've had 26 land use permits submitted. And because of the way people can get multiple licenses as far as cultivations are concerned, those 26 people have applied for 59 of those cultivation licenses. So that leaves us 82 we can still distribute. And that's as of the last couple of days. So those numbers are pretty current. Maybe pause here for 20 seconds. Any questions on that? Because this often gets a little confusing. If I don't see it, I'll move on. Yeah, please.
Go ahead. You mentioned testing is prohibited.
No.
Testing for what?
So testing is allowed within the unincorporated area. We do allow the testing license. So as part of the processing, let's say you're a cultivator, before you can sell your product or even send it through the supply chain to an end consumer, it must be tested by law for pesticides, molds, funguses, all that sort of stuff. Now, there aren't entirely clear rules, some would say, around what has to be tested for, but it's the intent is to test the product to make sure it's safe and we know what's in it. I think that's an area that will continue to evolve with state legislation.
You'll probably return to these items, and I was curious to know a little more about the status of resentencing, and also, are there any functional tests for impairment? If you know, if blood levels or breathalyzer levels are,
yeah,
unfortunately, how would a highway patrolman decide if somebody just looks stoned out of their mind, but has what sort of criteria will they use to keep them off the road?
Yeah. There isn't anything like a blood alcohol test that can be administered today. Instead, they would look for other things, like we do with other drugs that aren't simply alcohol, right? There are lots of other drugs out there that people unfortunately take and then drive. So they would be looking for other indicators, you know. So they might get them for reckless driving because they're driving, I'll call it, improperly. Mm-hmm. But they can't necessarily say it's because you're over some level, because that hasn't been established, unlike with alcohol.
So impaired driving is legal?
No. No, you'd still be driving, well, as long as you can effectively drive safely, I suppose you could argue that that's legal, yeah. But, you know, people drive when they've been drinking, and they shouldn't be doing that either, right?
Right.
It's certainly not something anybody would recommend or is lobbying for that I'm hearing. So, yeah. Penny looks like she wants to weigh in.
Well, I would just add to that, there are functional tests that can be done. It's not a biologic test, but law enforcement can cite someone for driving while impaired on the basis of failing certain functional tests.
Right. But they're more along the lines with other impairments, unique
so,
to cannabis.
Right. If you fail to be able to walk the line or do certain, you know, equilibrium tests, what have you, you can still be cited for that. And I do just want to add, because this is just one point that on the public health side, University of San Diego was given a small piece of money to work toward developing a field sobriety test based on...
You stole my thunder.
Oh,
I was going to get to that.
I'm so sorry.
Slides. Doggone it. That's okay. We'll come back to that one. No,
that's reassuring.
Yeah.
Quick question, yeah. So when I look at this statistic, the land use permit application were 26. So out of 172, to 26 people are going to grow in outdoor in a land? Is that what it is?
It's a mix of indoor and outdoor. So, for instance, some might be applying for an indoor license and an outdoor license on the same property because the different license types allow you to do different things.
I see. That's on a land use permit application. Can be both indoor and outdoor.
Right. So you would get one you get one land use permit, but under that land use permit, you might get a license for indoor grow and outdoor grow, for instance, or multiple outdoor grows.
Right. The question.
But you have to have a land use permit in order to grow indoor.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is when I looked at the Mendocino, Humboldt counties, where it was illegal growing, and they were doing a lot of them are doing indoor. So when they were how they were doing it was they were purchasing or leasing all these houses and gutting it out and then making it as basically virtually marijuana farm in houses. It ruins the entire house, obviously. And these people are like leasing, renting, and landlords. I mean, the people who own these properties sometimes are not aware this is happening. And we already have a housing situation here. You know, we have a shortage of housing and whatnot. I think, is there a way that we can create a rule that the indoor growing cannot be done in residential housing or property that's built to be used as residential?
Yeah, we actually, that's included in our ordinance already. I forget the exact language, but it says no structure originally intended for occupation by humans or something to that effect can be used as a cultivation site. So that exists in our ordinance today.
Perfect.
Thank you. By the way, if you get into areas like residential zoned property, if I go back to that other slide about, you know, the acreage and all that sort of stuff, it's not allowed in residential neighborhoods that are zoned for residential uses to cultivate. It's just not allowed. Other than personal. Sorry, let me be real clear about that. Somebody could do their personal grow, but I'm talking commercial here.
And I just wanted for clarification, when we're talking about these 26, that's just in the unincorporated areas.
You're
because it could be
correct.
Different in the cities.
Yeah, although as I noted on that one slide, I think only Grover Beach allows cultivation, and they only allowed indoor. So yes, these numbers are just county numbers. Mm-hmm. What Grover is up to is completely separate. So I think they're allowing, it's a limited number, 6. I think it was 4 storefronts and 6 I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact numbers. I'd have to. But it's a small number comparatively.
Do you know if they have paid attention to the residential piece that was just talked about?
I believe they limited it to industrial only because they had that whole industrial zone that they were looking at.
Right.
So I believe they did. Yeah, most of the things that you're describing there, those were illegal grows from the get-go. So I'm not going to stand here and try and tell you, I'm 100% certain it'll never happen in one of our houses because who knows what people will do. But yeah, our ordinance does prohibit it.
I had a quick question on the testing too.
Yeah.
Is that state mandated?
Yes, Prop 64 requires testing.
Okay.
In fact, the original AUMA and MRSA rules had a very stringent set of rules. I'm trying not to go too far down a rabbit hole here, but you know, if you went from one business to another, so cultivation to distributor to retailer, right? That's your supply chain, right? From the supply to the end consumer. They at one time required, for instance, you to pass as a cultivator your product to a distributor who would be an independent party who was actually going to do the testing to ensure that you're not playing any games on the front end, right? Now, under Prop 64, they allowed some vertical integration of that supply chain. So some of that separation isn't there any longer. But for the most part, the rules are there to help ensure that if there is product out there that's legal through the track and trace system, so on and so forth, that it's been tested. And they test samples, right? They don't test everything, right? They test samples.
Another question, sorry. About the dispensaries.
Yeah.
I've noticed, actually, and neighbors in Grover Beach, I don't live there, but I was being told that a lot of their retail spaces are being converted into dispensaries. Have you heard that? They said, yeah, they're around the corner everywhere, the dispensaries in Grover Beach.
No,
they're
Grover,
concerned.
Yeah, so to my knowledge, Grover only licensed 4 medical dispensaries, and I believe they just said they would add 2 retail. That's 6. Now, I will tell you that in conversations with Grover Beach staff, there was, before their rules came through, a lot of pressure to buy the right property so that when and if somebody were able to obtain a storefront dispensary license, they would have a property. They had to do that in order, I believe, to apply. So there might have been some pressure. But it's not because they actually opened a dispensary. It was kind of speculation about being able to open a dispensary. And they may be betting that, okay, longer term, they said 4, and then whatever the other number was, 2 for adult use, they're going to allow more of them. Somebody may be, you know, kind of placing a bet on that. But it's limited today. So there you have it. Now, I guess, sorry, thinking a little loud about this, I suppose there could be some other folks that are doing delivery only. So when you get into dispensaries, there's really, at the broader level, think of it as 2 types of licenses. There's this thing called a non-storefront dispensary, which means a delivery service, right? You have a business and no storefront. Nobody can walk in. And then storefront. That's what Grover has licensed most recently is storefronts, and they've selected the folks that will do that. So there could be some more on this side in the non-storefront delivery service that are technically dispensaries because it's, you know, they're providing product. But those wouldn't be open to the public anyway. And if one were next door, other than a lot of coming and going, you probably wouldn't necessarily even know what's going on because nobody can come there to pick up product, right? It would just be, you know, somebody taking it from there to some other location. We're rolling now. 8:30, right? Yeah. Go ahead, please.
Just a clarification question on dispensing the product. Is there state law or is it more at the county level that gets to decide where that's sold? So I guess my question is, will cannabis be sold only in a designated dispensary, or can, say, a smoke shop sell in addition to selling other types of products?
So there is state law that provides some of what you're describing. The physical ware, for instance, if you look at Grover Beach, they said in this area, not in this area. And within the county, we haven't done that yet, but I do envision a situation where somebody might come forward if we were to allow storefronts, we might come through and do what we often call an overlay and say, look, if you draw out all the unincorporated areas, we might allow them here, here, and here, but not here because it doesn't make any sense. Interesting discussion on this part of it. Early on, I may have shared this with you a year ago. Early on when this was coming forward, one of the things that do we have any city managers who were here then? I guess Jim Lewis in FSMO. In the early discussions around cannabis, one of the things we talked about was, you know, there aren't, while we certainly have communities like Cambria and in Napomo, most of our citizenry lives in a city. And so, at least in my very simple mind, I thought, you know, maybe we ought to make a deal with the cities that we'll allow all the cultivation out in the ag lands of the unincorporated area, and you cities take care of the dispensary side of it. Again, in my oversimplified mind, that would mean you're delivering product where people mostly live, right? Cities didn't want to go for that. I understand, but it's kind of to your question, right? It's like, so where are we going to allow dispensaries? And right now, at least in the unincorporated area, we're saying anywhere, but you can't have people come to that door to get product. The state law does create some separation to your question about smoke shops. You can't sell it the same place you sell alcohol. There's any number of rules. All right, let me go through the rest of these, and then we'll have some more questions. So enforcement, this is a question people often ask me. Well, what's going on with enforcement, Guy? You know, I hear about all these Cal Valley things firing back up. We have put out an RFP and received responses for cannabis hearing officers. Think of them as like a judge, but they're hearing officers. We do this with other land use things. We do this on housing assessments and all sorts of things. So they're somebody who's legally trained in performing this sort of a service. The primary focus that we'll be looking at least initially, is abating, meaning tearing out or otherwise addressing illegal cultivations. We still do have a number of illegal cultivations out there, folks that either didn't register under 3334 or who did but have said, well, I'm not going to get a license, I'm going to just try and keep growing. Cal Valley continues to be a problem. Unfortunately, we told all those folks to a person, those that registered under 3334 were allowed to move their operation somewhere else. We told them, you can keep cultivating, you just can't do it here, right? We think that there might be a few of them that are continuing to grow out there. So the first hearings are in just a couple weeks here, May 22nd. We've got hearings to potentially abate those locations, and the hearings are in this room on May 22nd. Could you click that for me? So we've been doing some video outreach, and here's one I wanted to share with you. It's about a minute and a half.
Here's how to report a cannabis ordinance violation.
Here's how to report a cannabis ordinance violation.
A message brought to you by the County of San Luis Obispo.
A list of some possible cannabis ordinance violations include the following.
That's okay. Let it go. There we go. Just let it go. Oh, you clicked me.
Visit the county website to learn more about SLO County's cannabis ordinance violations. Do you see or smell a problem? Reporting a cannabis ordinance violation is as easy. Here's how to report a cannabis ordinance violation. A message brought to you by the County of San Luis Obispo. A list of some possible cannabis ordinance violations include the following. Visit the county website to learn more about SLO County's cannabis ordinance violations.
You stopped it.
Do you see or smell a problem? Reporting a cannabis ordinance violation is as easy as reporting it online. A phone call to the County Planning and Building Department, or visiting their office at the Old County Courthouse Building on Oso Street. If county code enforcement suspects any of the codes have been violated, the case is then sent to a county cannabis hearing officer, other county officials, or in criminal cases, the district attorney. Visit our website to learn more about the County of San Luis Obispo's cannabis regulations, license and permit requirements, how to report a suspected violation, and more.
We did away with the wireless mouse. So I brought that up just to show that we are doing a bunch of different outreach. These are YouTube. You can get to them through our Facebook page. We tweeted them out when we created them. And we're doing a number of mini vignettes like this. Like I said, that slide a few slides ago that I handed you the pamphlet on, there's one on Know Before You Grow. We've got a number of them under works just to try and get some of this word out there. We're also trying to collaborate with Dr. Penny's office and some of her staff, with the cities, to try and create a kind of seamless approach to some of our local government communications, so that as we're getting the word out, we're doing it consistently with the same messaging to try and have a better impact with them. So upcoming, here's a couple of upcoming things, just in a little less than a month, right? We've got the June 5th ballot, which the county will have a taxation measure on. It's listed here, as you can see, we're going to do what we call a general tax. And what that means is that any taxes gained through this tax would go into the general fund. It could be used for any purpose. They're not specifically tied to cannabis-related things, but it's entirely possible that we would use it for things like education, like enforcement, like some of the other things that we know are coming or that have already arrived that we don't have funding to help address. I don't see us creating any specific program saying, oh, you know, I'm going to make this up, 20% of that cannabis funding should go to this new program. I don't see us doing that because it's going through the general fund. So I think that's one of the reasons even Supervisor Pichon, who would normally be completely against any new tax, is supporting this one. It's gross receipts based. There are a lot of different models, and when we looked at the different models, to us, any taxation made sense more as a gross receipt. So the more somebody earns through their cannabis sales, the more we'll receive in return. It's not ramped up like our income tax. It's not like, you know, you make this much, you 2%, that much 4%. It's flat, but it's based on gross receipts. So if a business is doing well, the county will receive more money, but that's where it kind of ends. It's scalable. The way the initiative is written, our taxes start at 4% of gross receipts, and unless something else happens, they'll go up by 2% to a maximum of 10%. The board can adjust that on any one of the various business license types at any time. So they could say, for instance, they said, you know what, testing is important to us, no tax. And so they've already said that. Because even though it's a cannabis-related business that we would otherwise be taxing at 4%, they've already said, we want, if we're going to put product out there, people to be safe. Why would we tax testing? So that's why it says it excludes testing facilities. I would say, you know, in our political environment right now, anytime we can get Adam Hill and John Pichon to sign on the same piece of paper, that's a good thing, and they both did. They're, the only people who have anything to say in your actual local ballot, so that's a good thing. I'll leave it at that. So here's an interesting, just quick side story I thought was kind of fun to try and drive home the point of how dynamic this industry is. So up in Oregon, they had this little problem. Mounds and mounds of weed and nothing to do with it because they overproduced by what they anticipate today is about three times what their need was. Of course, you can't transport it legally across state lines because that's a federal offense. So you've got three times the weed you need. What do you do with it? Well, in typical, you know, economies like ours, that means the price drops. And so what they saw here, and you can see by the graphic here that I borrowed from Bridge City Collective, you know, wholesale was $1,200 a pound in 2017, about $2.67 a gram. This year it dropped to $700 a pound or $1.56 a gram. So more than a dollar drop per gram. At the retail side, that translated into about $2 a gram by the time you go through all the processing and get it to an end user. So that's a pretty significant drop. They're seeing a lot of businesses that went into the cultivation side of this that don't have an outlet. Because if you grew a bunch, right, and you're trying to sell it and you can't get what you've got into it, you've got a problem as a seller, right? So they saw a real strong connection, interestingly, between if you were a grower and had a storefront on the other end, you had a guaranteed route for your product. But if you were just a grower, sometimes people were getting a lot less than $700 a pound for wholesale cannabis. So it's just kind of an interesting thing to say, this is an economy we don't understand yet, right? It's an emerging economy. I don't think anybody, if you'd asked anybody in the industry, anybody who's affiliated with the industry, if you'd have said to them even 2 months ago or 3 months ago, which county is going to have the most licenses? They'd have all said, you know, Humboldt, Mendocino. What's the answer? I think we all know. Santa Barbara has the most cultivation licenses in the entire state. And it's primarily in Carpinteria. Nobody would have guessed that, right? I mean, it's an economy we just don't understand yet. Here's the slide Penny kind of stole my thunder a little bit on. It's okay, though. So with the videos we've been putting out and all of the Facebook articles and on our Twitter and Instagram, every social media outlet we've got staff going to various school meetings and all sorts of things to try and get the word out about safe usage, legal usage, those sorts of things. And we've been within my office, we have a communications analyst who's helped me put together a communication plan built around these three groups. You know, you have the industry folks that need things like this pamphlet that says know before you grow so that they don't do something illegal. You have businesses that are wondering, well, what does this mean for my business? How can I treat cannabis? Can I test my employees? Can I send them home? Is it legal for them to be stoned at work? You know, those sorts of questions. And then there's just the general public, like the video I showed a minute ago. That one's really kind of more targeted the general public. If you smell something, see it, how to report it. So we do have a pretty significant outreach program. I expect it to grow. That's one of the things, as I mentioned earlier, that I think some of the taxation dollars would be used for, at least in our local area, to increase the amount of communication. So this is my last slide. So what's next? Well, within our ordinance, we're taking advantage of a California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, exemption that allows us to not have to do a countywide CEQA as far as all this cultivation. Instead, we're doing a project-by-project CEQA. So if you want to be a cultivator, you have to prove from a CEQA perspective that you're doing something that you're either offsetting correctly or it's allowed under CEQA. In most cases, it means you're replacing a prior agricultural kind of product with cannabis, and therefore you can show how that works. That exemption goes away at the end of the year, so that's why we're kind of tied to that 141 number and trying to get folks through the process. And part of the reason that, as I said there in the third bullet, it's going really slowly because there's a lot that cultivators in particular have to do. And for those that, I think many cultivators said, yeah, you know, we want to be out in the daylight. We want to do this legally. And then they come in and they find out they have to pay things like traffic mitigation payments for all the vehicle trips. And I had a grower come to me the other day and said, Guy, did you know it's going to be $115,000 for my traffic trips? I said, well, how big's your operation? He described it to me. I said, how many employees do you have? He described it to me. And I said, yeah, seems about right. Because they forget about, you know, that's how we fund things like roads and code enforcement and other things, is by some of those things that normal businesses all have to pay. So I think there's been a bit of an eye-opener for folks on that front. Coastal Commission, remember, we deal with coastal and inland. So our coastal ordinance is slated to be heard in June down in San Diego. So currently, if you're in the coastal zone, you can't get the permits you want because it has to go through the coastal zone first. So after June, we can begin talking about the folks that live in that area, or those areas, rather. The fourth bullet there, industrial hemp, this has been a growing one over the last several weeks that we're trying to decide how best to kind of get in front of. So industrial hemp, just for those who don't know, comes from the same base plant of cannabis. Typically, people think of it as very low THC. In fact, it's defined as 0.03% THC, very, very low, meaning the psychoactive content is so low you wouldn't even notice it, basically. But they're coming out with strains that pump up the CBD, which is a cannabinoid, which many folks believe is the real benefit on the medicinal side. And so you can get strains of hemp that are extremely high in CBDs, which means you can then press or do some other extraction techniques to get the CBD oils out and reuse those. Well, that's all well and good, and I think great for those folks that believe that that's the medicinal side of it. The problem is, except for through testing, you can't really tell the difference between the plants. So historically, industrial hemp has been grown much more just like you would see a wheat field, meaning, you know, just it's everywhere, and there's no individual tending of plants. With high CBD content hemp, you tend to want to tend individual plants. So from somebody just driving by on the street, it would look just like any other cannabis grow. And in fact, we do have some folks that are trying to say, no, I'm growing hemp. And we, no, you can't do that either, actually, just yet, because there's some state rules that need to be established. There's a statewide industrial hemp advisory board that hasn't done its proper rulemaking yet to allow folks within the state of California. But we're trying to figure this out because there's some weird exemptions in state law that we want to make sure just aren't a problem. And it's easier if we just kind of get in front of it, we think. So we're talking about what to do with industrial hemp. I've talked to folks like the Farm Bureau. I've spoken to Normal. I've spoken to all the local cannabis groups. And for the most part, they're okay with where we're talking about potentially going. because they recognize we're only talking about doing anything most likely until this advisory board comes out with its rules and says, this is how you can do hemp. And then my last bullet here, more state changes, sorry. It seems like we, on a daily basis, hear something. There are seven new Assembly or Senate bills at the state legislature going on right now related to cannabis, dealing with all sorts of things. So that's the sort of changes we're seeing all the time. Plus, we have interpretations by courts as far as different offshoots of the cannabis discussion that we're trying to absorb at the same time. So this is a space that you could probably have me back in a year, and we could have a completely different conversation because it continues to evolve and change. And that's my info if you need it. And like I said, I'll make sure you all get this presentation. With that, more questions, good. I'm sure.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll have some more questions. One quick one on the little YouTube thing.
Yeah.
Are there going to be any PSA announcements that are broadcast so we can get out to...
Yeah, those are not free, and they're actually quite expensive. That's why I mentioned earlier that'd be something we would look really hard at. Should we be able to use some taxation dollars for that? We don't have, you know, just getting started. We, too, are just getting our arms around this, right? So the limited funds we set aside are mostly going right now towards enforcement because we've got some issues that need to be addressed. And it's really about existing businesses. It's not about educating the public. But, yeah, PSAs, you know, I think we all see on local broadcast TV, there's a guy, I don't know where he's from, I'm assuming he lives in Santa Maria, that does all the safety walking and driving commercials about safety
in the
crosswalks and all that. I'd love to see some things like that that give the appropriate message. They're tricky, right, with a product like this because we're targeting an over 21 crowd and an under 21 crowd, whereas his message is about, you know, safely crossing the streets and wearing colors people can see. That applies to all of us. This product isn't quite like that, so it's a little more difficult.
You have to kind of be attuned to the audience you're trying to reach.
Yeah, that's why we've been sticking more to social media channels because we can better identify our audiences through those.
Okay. What about out to, like, our senior citizen centers where people...
I've spoken to two of them
all the time.
I get odd requests from different groups, and I'm happy to go out and talk day, evening about the product and help people understand. That's all part of our outreach program.
Okay, good.
Yes, I had a kind of a twofold question, and it has to do with manufacturing and if there was any of that here in the county. And something I've noticed recently in some of the usually places that have got some kind of health food or that, that there's items in there that contain CBD oil, and is that legal?
Yes, is the short answer to the last one. And yes, we have restrictions. We do allow manufacturing, but not volatile using, I'm going to get probably scolded for this, explosive materials. I mean, if you're just using presses and heat and water, those sorts of things to manufacture or extract CBD oils, you can do that within the county. You can get those licenses. If you're using the butane kinds of approaches that were explosive in people's garages and other things, those are not allowed at this point. I think that answers them. I'm not sure.
Well, it does kind of. But also, what about, you know, the gummy candies and those kinds of things? Do we have, or have we looked at any kind of restrictions on things that, that children might pick up?
Yeah, we were a little ahead of the state on this one. We banned, as part of our original standard ordinance, animals... anything shaped like, there were three categories. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. It was animals, things that kids would like. so it wouldn't look like candies, basically. We said, no, you can't even produce those or sell them in those shapes. And then the state came along and did the same thing, actually.
Okay, so and those items will are is there a state mandate for them also to have some kind of a seal on them?
The labeling and packaging of THC laden gummies or other edibles it's there. Yeah, so this is one of the questions a lot of people have is, you know, how we get to I'm going to put this in air quotes, standards around what THC contents, how those should be described. The state's working on it, but they're not quite there yet. There are lots of thoughts, competing thoughts on how best to do that, because you want to, you know, for instance, you hear the story all the time about, you know, people will buy these cookies, and the cookies are sectioned in such a way to try and give you a consistent dose. So they'll take one section of the cookie and eat it, and then, you know, well, I'm feeling fine. 20 minutes later, they'll take another because they're not feeling it. But an hour later, after they've eaten the entire cookie, which was intended maybe for a couple of days, they end up in the emergency room because they think they're going to die. They're not, most likely, but that's part of the labeling and packaging and making sure people understand that this is a product that doesn't have an immediate impact, right? The effects may linger or be delayed for some period of time.
Are there any restrictions on quantity when it comes to delivery?
Yes. I don't know them off the top of my head. So you can't call up and say, hey, bring me a pound.
No, I wonder about, like, social events and gatherings. Like, I've seen advertisements for, like, weddings, if you want to have, like, a cannabis wedding or serve cannabis at your wedding for your guests and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to understand what that looks like.
Yeah, that's a really interesting space that there's that the state and local jurisdictions are trying to deal with. The cannabis cup was it 3 weeks ago now up in the northern part of the county or state rather, and we had our own local version on 420 here toward Pismo Beach. Those are, as I understand it, considered closed events. And so it's closed event on a private parcel often, not always. Some of them are at fairgrounds and other things. But again, some of these other restrictions like, well, you can't have a cannabis cup and have the distillery cup in the same venue, right? So you can have alcohol and cannabis in the same venue. So that's one of those areas when I talked about state rules continue to evolve. This is one of the areas that I think will continue to evolve. There's no ability today, for instance, for somebody to go to a farmer's market and sell in a farmer's market, which I think is important because there's kids there and other things. So, Gina, looks like she's going to hit her leg.
Cool question. Okay, so about the, I guess, you know, I've been told now, because I'm in a medical field, some of my patients are telling me that when they grow cannabis at their home, which they're allowed to do, mm-hmm. it's not as potent mm-hmm. as the ones they can purchase from commercial growers because they make it modified or add something in there. It's a lot more highly potent, and I was kind of reading about it, and it seemed to be more dangerous.
Yeah,
and they interact with the opiate as well. So yeah. I was wondering, is there any? Are we going to have a rule on type of cannabis they can grow or type of cannabis they can dispense? So we can kind of, minimize the potential health risk.
Yeah, you know, there is no question that the different strains that can be grown in these days manipulated to increase or lower THC and or CBD content levels. I think about it, and I know it's probably an unfair analogy, but I think it helps draw the picture. You know, if I'm a home beer brewer, right, mm-hmm. I can put together a batch of beer that might be 3%, 5%, 7%, 9% alcohol, but I can go over to a local establishment and, you know, you'll see beers with all sorts of different alcohol content. And I think the key thing in this one is back to the question about labeling and packaging and potency. If you're going to buy it, right, that you understand what it is you're buying and how potent it is. Whether we would ever get to trying to regulate or control what somebody's growing in their home, that would be interesting. Because for personal use, which means you don't have to have a license, just like I don't have to have a license to do a home brew of my beer, right? That'd be interesting. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that one, but who knows?
Yeah. This seems like an all-consuming topic for your office these days.
Not as bad as it was.
And I'm just curious, has it monopolized a significant portion of your administrative duties, this new, vague, rapidly evolving and socially contentious issue?
Yeah, there's no question that it has taken not just my time, but a lot of folks' time. We added, I think in the end, the count was 6.5 staff to this year's budget to help address all of the various issues. And that didn't even begin to touch the health side of things, because in my conversations with then health agency director Jeff Hamm, he kind of said, "Guy, I'm not even sure what I would ask for at this point," because he could speculate, but he couldn't tie it. Unlike, for instance, the ag commissioner said, "Look, if you have 100 registrations, that equates to this many ag commissioner, whatever they call them, the folks who go out into the field. I can make that tie, and I can show you all the numbers." Planning said, "If you're going to have 150 applicants, and they all have to go through CEQA, we know how long that takes per applicant, so you know, you just do the simple math." There are other areas, like I said, with the health agency, where we have some thoughts about what it might mean, but you can't necessarily say, because it's shifting so fast and things like, well, THC potencies and other things, you can't create those same ties. Now, Dr. Penny may say, "Guy, I disagree," which she's fine to do, and we have a great relationship, and she'd be free to do that, and I'd be fine with it. But the point is, we expect that there's going to be more that has to be done on the social impact side and other areas. We're just not, I'm not able to articulate them today. Penny may be able to. I'll give her that.
Yeah, we talk about this internally quite a bit, and I don't really much disagree with Guy, much as I might like to. No, I'm kidding.
What fun is that? It's Monday.
No, it is. We very much anticipate that there will be a number of issues that arise. We know this from other states that have been, you know, the Poison Control Center, that's not something we run. So, is there a need for education for the emergency room, you know, kinds of things that they're going to be seeing? Breastfeeding moms we deal with through our WIC program, through our home visiting. Is there going to be, a new number of folks seeking our drug and alcohol services in the behavioral health side of the health agency? Yes, perhaps. How many? You know, so I think some of it really will. We don't want to be regressive and, you know, wait for things to happen, but it's also hard to be as proactive as we might be in other areas without a really clear picture of, you know, exactly what kind of staff, or is it incremental? You know, we struggle a lot with. So if you have to add 5 minutes to a home visiting conversation, does that equate to an FTE at the end of the day? So I think that we'll be working very closely with the administrative office as this moves forward as to what kind of things we'll be seeing, and trying to, that's what I just keep saying to everyone, is we're really trying to stay tuned in, you know, not be necessarily out front, but not be, you know, be caught unawares.
So with that, the second Monday of May 2019, we'll expect to have you back, right? And give us an update on what we're doing. One last question, sure. Actually, Penny, that might tie in, Guy, also. You know how Anne does all her statistics and whatever. I saw a thing on TV the other night from Colorado, and they had the numbers of how many ER visits had come about and just a whole cadre of different statistics. I'm assuming we're going to collect those things also so that...
Yeah, California Department of Public Health is definitely looking at a number of metrics similar to what Colorado has done. They're also hopeful that because we've had the experience of other states before us, that they're going into it with their eyes more open and able to stave off some of the kinds of problems that we're seeing in some other jurisdictions or states. And I guess I would say one more thing about the, I think it was Tomar, who asked about, you know, advertising, marketing, or actually what's the word that we use with tobacco? Not inverse marketing, but reverse marketing. Anyway, yeah. There's a word I'm forgetting, which is something that CDPH, this State Department of Public Health, did get a one-time infusion of funding, and they are have been and will continue for a period of time rolling out at a state level some of those educational messages, but their funding is going to go away. And I just came back from a state meeting. The state Secretary of Public Health said, we're going to be done, and we're hoping that you all can look toward your local jurisdictions with tax revenues to be in the game, if you will. The state has very clearly in legislation, they have four tiers of where the taxes, so you saw there's some pretty good state taxes built on top of product, but none of that is slated for local jurisdictions. Basically the message was these kinds of things after this one time, upfront effort is going to be really left to local jurisdictions. So again, that's an area we'd be working with county administration and their public information office on those kinds of things. If indeed our taxes were to generate enough to do everything that needs to be done at the enforcement level, law enforcement, code enforcement, et cetera. So,
I guess on that front, if I could just real quick, we did, I talked about some positions we added this year, for folks like planning, the planning officer or planning folks we added, our fee schedule isn't set up to recover their costs for doing that work, so that's part of what those new businesses are paying for. But there are some areas where we can't charge a fee, right? So, for instance, fees, the simple way to think of it is our fees are set up to recover costs for legitimate legal businesses, but we can't charge legal businesses fees to pay for enforcement on illegal businesses. So when I talk about enforcement, some measures of enforcement are actually built into those fees. We'll have a monitoring program for the legitimate businesses. But some of that taxation dollar would be used to help cover the illegal enforcement. And that's kind of how I often think of how it will get divided. And, our tax collector, who is the sponsor, and I'm sure you all have heard the kind of joke, Jim Erb is our auditor, controller, treasurer, tax collector, and, of course, jokingly, this has become known as the Erb tax. Great play on words there, I have to say. We've talked about the kind of revenue it could bring, and we're trying to be pretty conservative. But, it could mean as much as $1 million a year. That's thus far this year, Santa Cruz County, I think, has seen about $870,000 from their fairly nascent cannabis industry. So $1 million may not be that unrealistic. That's a lot of money to do education and other things. So,
and I just want to add, we'll know what's going on in the code enforcement area in terms of complaints, because now I know why we get so many calls. 5600, first time I saw the phone number, is for the public to, that's one digit off from our public health main number.
They get a lot of public health calls, too, I'll tell you.
I was wondering, so occasionally I pick up the phone and get a code enforcement call. Now I know why.
Sue, did you have another question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. When we were talking about the PSAs and some of that, one of the other areas that I've noticed is veterinarians complaining. And with our senior population here, we might want to do some PSAs regarding their pets.
Yeah. Meaning pets get a hold of things that are left on tabletops,
yes,
and other things. And their
and the veterinarians
beat differently than ours do, so it has a different effect on animals. There are veterinarians that are looking at this product, particularly CBD-based products for pet care.
Right, but I thought that I'd read that in Colorado and some of these other places, they've seen an increase in the pets getting into that and having the emergency calls.
Just like the humans, right, who unintentionally or intentionally overpartake in this particular product. So, there's no question that you see the stories about the little chihuahua or something that ended up eating somebody's cookie and wasn't too happy afterward.
Definitely an evolving story, if you will, right? Lots of things to watch for. Well, thank you very much. That was very enlightening. Lots of good information, and I'm glad that it will be run over and over and again on our
website so that people can watch it.
Yeah, and I'd just like to say thanks for the invite. Really, you know, anything we can do with this massive audience, and I know the thousands of listeners that are online right now watching this, anything we can do to get the message out directly or indirectly, I think is just a fabulous thing. So I'm more than happy to come because I think that
education... Well, it was a great presentation, and I think people do. I mean... It may be the middle of the night when they're watching or whatever, but it always astounds me how many people really watch that.
I agree.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Trying to make a little joke there. Okay. Just, like I said.
Well, it was nice to see you, and we'll see you again next year. Okay? All right. So, Dr. Bornstein, you are... Oh, so, Jean, you will send out the handouts to everybody, like you always do. Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. You know what? If you don't mind leaving them with Jean, I think we can all of us take a few of them as far as it goes. Thanks, Guy. Dr. Bornstein, you want to do your report for us, please?
Thanks. So I have a couple of good news items from the governor's May revise. So every year in May, the governor submits his budget in January, and then when he gets more intelligence from department heads and tax revenues and a whole bunch of things, it's called the May revise, second week in May, to say, okay, I want to tighten down some things in my budget proposal. And so to our surprise, my surprise, and I think a lot of people in the public health business, there were a couple of proposals. It still has to get through the state legislature, but usually in this state, we have a pretty strong executive. So one of the proposals was to cover through Medi-Cal undocumented individuals between the ages of 19 and 25. I guess consistent with you can stay on your parents' plan up until the age of 26. It is, you know, another step in the direction of trying to come at all angles through seniors and young children and now, you know, young adults to get all residents of the state, regardless of immigration status, covered. So for those of us who are often posed with, well, what do I do with my, you know, relative who needs this health care but has no way of getting covered through health care, this would be an additional mechanism. And another item was, gosh, and I'm not remembering the exact amount, but I believe it had a B, as in billion, state revenues directed toward the treatment of hepatitis C. So that was really some welcome news. And in particular, I saw some of the report on this that is definitely slated to cover those who are in prison. Those individuals, when they're incarcerated, lose their health insurance, public health insurance, so Medicaid or Medicare. But this would be state revenue being used for medical expenses for those who are incarcerated. What I haven't been able to figure out yet is if it might also cover jail inmates. We haven't done treatment in county jail, and I think that's common across the state because it's a very expensive course of treatment, but also because the timeline for individuals staying in jail is much more erratic and much more brief in most cases. So that will be interesting to follow. But certainly now that you can affect cure in as little as 8 weeks and more typically 12 weeks, we should be able to bring down the burden of hepatitis C transmission in our state quite a bit if that does go through. Mention the tax bill for cannabis. I'm not lobbying. I'm not allowed to. But on June 6th, the voters will get to decide if there will be any source of revenue, some of which could possibly come to public health for just the kinds of things we were talking about. And, one very important announcement is that the health agency will have its new director in place as of Monday. His official name is Richard Michael Hill, but he goes by Mike Hill. So we told our deputy director, Mike Stevens, he may have to change the way in which we'll have to figure out which Mike gets precedence, but there'll be two executive Mikes in our health agency. One is the director, Mike Hill, who is coming to us from the state of Illinois, where he has been a director of a county public health department outside of Chicago, McHenry County, and this was in the news as well, but I assume in case any of our commissioners missed it, you would very much want to hear this detail. So we are looking forward to having him on board a week from today. And we also, and he's going to have his hands full from day one because the county is facing a challenging fiscal year coming up and into the foreseeable future. So though the health agency carries an awful lot of vacancies because we have a lot of turnover, we have people move out of state, we have problem, you know, in some areas, retention problems because people don't have an advancement opportunity, what have you, recruitment. We still struggle mightily with getting nurses to come work for us, but we're living now under an additional, what the county's calling the hiring chill, is in order to deal with the fiscal deficit, is not not doing furloughs, not cutting positions, not making, you know, a change in the base budget, but asking us to purposefully slow down the pace at which we hire unless there's an emergency need for a position. So in some cases, that has no effect, where we've been looking for nurses for a year or two. To slow down by 2 to 4 weeks really doesn't matter. But it is overall, the county employment picture is creating a little bit of anxiety for, you know, it already takes a little bit of time to hire. So now with this additional imperative of a slowdown, it's a little bit more challenging, but we're so still moving ahead.
You're not going to lose your assistant position, are you?
No. Okay. In fact, I have some interviews coming up in the next week, and hopeful that we'll be able to fill that in the relatively near term. So, and if Sheriff Parkinson's listening, you cannot have one more of my deputies. I'm kidding. He got a great position to come work at the jail. But so we're back at the drawing board, and I believe that I have some really good candidates. So. And on top of that, the labor management negotiations are going on right now, and a lot of tension around wage issues and some other rising costs of health care and pension, et cetera. And so,
must be great to come to work.
Yeah, right? it's a challenging period of time, but the county has been here before. Management has been here before. County employees are really they're committed. They're hardworking. They're really brave, intelligent, and you know the money situation. And hopefully, without too much blood, sweat, and tears, we'll get to a place where everyone can move forward together. But we might, you know, there might be some rough times before we get there. But so that's what's going on in our world.
So our one case of measles that happened a couple weeks or so ago.
So we are still in the incubation period from potential transmission from the one case that has been positively identified as an individual who had traveled out of our county and was under-immunized, turned up with measles disease. And the tricky thing about a lot of these easily spread viral illnesses like chickenpox, measles, mumps, flu, et cetera, is often the ability to transmit precedes symptoms. And with measles, that's very much true. It can be a few days before the rash onset. And so, and then the incubation period, so from the time that it might be transmitted from one person to another, for that exposed person to be cleared, to be out of the woods from having develop illness can be up to 3 weeks. So we're still in that period. So hopefully in another week to 9 days, I think, in that range, we'll be out of the clear in terms of any spread in our county.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Bernstein?
I saw on our website that tomorrow there's Northern County, they're having some kind of like town meeting sort of about discussing a effects of cannabis on growing brain. Do you know anything about it? So a lot of behavioral health people seem to be involved.
Effects of cannabis on the growing brain, you said?
Yeah, the brain. Oh. Yeah, for adolescent brain. Something like that. That's what I saw online. I'm not sure whether that's still going on. It's in Templeton or Paso or in the Northern County.
I'm sorry that I am not aware of that.
I was going to ask a guy, but I...
I don't know if that's coming out of our agency, out of behavioral health, or if it's an advocacy group.
Behavioral health people, yeah.
Okay.
Tomorrow, actually. It's between 6:30 and 8:30.
Okay. Well, let's move on to commissioner updates. Susan, do you want to start?
The Homeless Services Oversight Council is going to be making a presentation tomorrow at the Board of Supervisors in the afternoon. And it is, they were asked to bring short-term and long-term affordable housing goals to the supervisors. And so that presentation will happen at the 1:30 session tomorrow afternoon. And anyway, that's so you can tune in or show up for that.
You're going?
I think so.
No updates.
Well, on the continuing saga of Oceano Dunes and dust, the overview of the issue is it's going to continue for quite some time. I'm sure all of you saw in the paper that state parks and air pollution control district agreed, presented a stipulated agreement to the hearing board as to how they would proceed to meet the requirements that the hearing board had set, which was basically a 50% reduction in emitted particulates over 5 years. And by agreeing to this stipulation, state parks avoided the risk of being found in violation of the state health and safety code. Looking at the agreement and hearing lots of testimony on it, it's clear that there is a lot of room to wiggle. It's going to be, it will ultimately turn into a political battle again. It's not quite that dire, but it's going to take constant monitoring, and the issue is not resolved in my mind.
So you'll keep participating and on top of it?
Oh, you bet.
Okay. Good, thanks. Gina?
Nothing today.
I have just a couple of things. The preventive health grant, CBO, we finished up all of our recommendations. It'll go next month during the budget hearings to our Board of Supervisors. In the public or preventive health grant, we're recommending $404,000 be distributed to the various organizations that submitted a request. And CBO, it's $1,066,500 that we are recommending. That could certainly change when it goes to the board as far as that goes. The Healthy Communities Work Group, our housing summit
or forum, I'm not sure what we're calling it, will be October the 4th at the Vets Hall here in San Luis Obispo. We'll all be getting invitations. We'll have a couple of, I think Kathleen has gotten some really nice speakers for that, and I think Dr. Borenstein's going to participate in some way as well. And then lastly, Oral Health will meet again on June the 5th. They have four subcommittees that are working on various things and are actually quite active with those. So those are my meetings for the last month or so. Remember, we're still... We lost our representative on oral health, so as we get some new commissioners, maybe we can get some help. I'll go again next month. I have it on my calendar, but maybe we can figure out who can do that on a regular basis. It's not every month that it meets anyway. It's every other month. It is kind of in the middle of the day during the lunch hour as far as that goes. Any of our standing committees have any reports this evening? I think from the nominating committee standpoint, we will have three vacancies on the commission, two consumer spots and one direct provider. So get out there and talk it up, and let's see if we can't get some candidates to fill those spots. It'd be nice to have a full commission again. So with that, anybody else have anything? If not, I think we'll stand adjourned. Thank you all for being here this evening.